Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Another grisly video released by IS militants, this time in Syria, and the G20 nations pledged to boost global economy and express unhappiness with Russia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Islamic State militants claim in a video posted on the internet today they have beheaded American aid worker Abdulrahman Kasig. A national security spokeswoman says the intelligence community is working as quickly as possible to determine the authenticity of the video, which shows a militant standing over a severed head he says belongs to Kasig. The video did not show the beheading. The militant speaks in a British accent, saying they are burying the first American crusader in the northern Syrian town of Dabig, and warns that U.S. soldiers will meet a similar fate. The same video shows beheadings of at least 18 men described as Syrian military personnel. World leaders sharply rebuked Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Brisbane G20 Economic Summit over Moscow's intervention in Ukraine. President Barack Obama said today Moscow will remain isolated internationally if Mr. Putin continues to violate laws and treaties aimed at ending Ukraine's internal conflict.
At this point, the sanctions that we have in place are biting plenty good. We retain the capabilities, and we have our teams constantly looking at mechanisms in which to turn up additional pressure as necessary.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper shook Mr. Putin's hand, but was quoted as saying, "I have only one thing to say to you. You need to get out of Ukraine." Australian Prime Minister called Mr. Putin to atone for shooting down a Malaysian passenger jet over a rebel-held portion of eastern Ukraine for the shooting down. And British Prime Minister David Cameron called Mr. Putin a bully. The president of Russia left Australia earlier than previously planned, saying he needed to get some sleep and that his early exit had nothing to do with tensions over Ukraine. This is VOA News. At the close of the meeting of the world's largest economies, the group released a plan to boost global domestic product by more than $2 trillion in the next 5 years by investing in infrastructure and increasing free trade. The document also pledged cooperation for strong action against climate change. The Democratic Republic of Congo has declared itself Ebola-free, with the outbreak that started in August declared officially over. The disease claimed nearly 50 lives. The DRC's health minister made the announcement on Saturday, but warned the outbreak's end does not mean the country is fully out of danger. Meantime, a surgeon who lives in the state of Maryland but was working in his native Sierra Leone has arrived in Omaha, Nebraska after contracting the disease. He will be treated at the Nebraska Medical Center, one of several U.S. hospitals equipped to handle Ebola patients. A new version of the hit song "Do They Know It's Christmas" was recorded Saturday in London, with the proceeds expected to help fight Ebola. Bob Geldof, who organized the original Band-Aid concerts to fight famine in Africa, encouraged fans to buy the song so that more resources can be sent to help fight Ebola in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
I spoke to the UN, and the truth of the matter is that they need 20 times now the resources that are in the three affected countries. 20 times. Not the money, but the resources, the people, the medicines, the hospitals. They need 20 times that.
The song has been reworked, with the words to the original version changed to reflect the current crisis. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is announcing a new effort focused on keeping and extending American military superiority. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the secretary and reports from Simi Valley, California.
The new Defense Innovation Initiative is a push for breakthroughs in cutting-edge technology, from robotics to big data and even three-dimension printing. Secretary Hagel talked about the initiative at the Reagan National Defense Forum, where he warned the Pentagon's technological advantage was eroding.
While we spent over a decade focused on grinding stability operations, countries like Russia and China have been heavily investing in military modernization programs to blunt our military's technological edge.
Hagel said financial management will be critical to change. He called on Congress to provide the military with an actual budget rather than passing temporary funding bills. Carla Babb, VOA News, Simi Valley, California.
A European spacecraft made history this past week by successfully landing hundreds of kilometers away on the icy, dusty surface of a speeding comet. An audacious first designed to answer big questions about the universe. However, by this weekend, the European Space Agency says the batteries of the comet lander, the probe, were depleted. It has, however, sent reams of data about its surroundings back to Earth. ESA says the lander was lifted Friday by about 4 centimeters and rotated a little bit, but out of power. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The statement he made was really very unfortunate for a member of parliament. His backward and his rights violating comment of the MP is a serious affront to gender equality.
A Ghanaian parliamentarian comes under fire for suggesting that women who commit adultery should die. We'll have a reaction.
Finally, there is a state of emergency and there are rules that, you know, guide that. So the government is saying generally should not report anything, any issue.
Sierra Leone restricts news reporting on Ebola-related stories. We'll have details.
I do not have the charges against me. I don't know what offense I committed. I'm still waiting to be informed.
And Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF carries out a major purge among the rank-and-file membership. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Ghanaian parliamentarian is coming under criticisms from feminine and civil society groups. This after calling for women who commit adultery to be stoned or hung to death while contributing to a debate in parliament. But parliamentarian Nelson Abudu Bani challenged his critics to come up with opposing arguments instead of heaping insults and verbally attacking him for exercising his freedom of expression as enshrined in the constitution. Abigail Edemhunu, Communication and Advocacy Officer for Women in Law and Development in Africa, told me earlier that the lawmaker was wrong in making what she says is an unfortunate pronouncement.
We are condemning the statement that he made. The statement he made was really very unfortunate for a member of parliament. His backward and his rights violating comment of the MP is a serious affront to gender equality, women's rights, and must be condemned by all who care about upholding human rights. His views are inimical to the standards and values of a modern rights-respecting nation like Ghana.
Well, but Ms. Edem, is he entitled to his opinion? And he, as a member of parliament, contributing to debate in parliament and freedom of expression that Ghana espouses?
Yes, he's entitled to that, but not on the floor of parliament. If you and I are having drinks and then having those kind of conversation, that is fine. He represents thousands of people, women inclusive, in parliament. So we are expecting him to make a more rights-recognizing comments on the floor of parliament. That's all that we are saying.
Some of his supporters are saying that he's being scapegoated by feminist groups or women's groups like yours for speaking his mind and supporting his stance on that fact. What do you make of those comments coming from his supporters?
Those comments are also very unfortunate. As I said, women's rights are human rights. So I seriously think anybody who really is interested in upholding human rights would also condemn his statement. Not just women. Men inclusive, women inclusive, children inclusive.
Some people say he should be allowed to make any statement in the floor of parliament because, in any case, the measure will be voted for, and since majority of people appear not to share his comments, then people should not worry about it. Why are women groups bothered or concerned about this statement?
We are concerned because Ghana is a party to all the major human rights treaties. We are very much concerned because if we are a party to human rights treaties, we expect that an organization or a body, so to speak, which is parliament, anybody who seeks to be a member of parliament or who is a member of parliament would make pronouncements that uphold these rights or treaties that we have assigned to.
Abigail Hedemhunu is the Communication and Advocacy Officer for Women in Law and Development in Africa. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Authorities in Sierra Leone have freed a journalist arrested 11 days ago for making supposedly disparaging comments about the country's effort to fight Ebola. Mohamed Kano is a journalist in Sierra Leone. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the capital, Freetown, to find out what exactly the government expects of journalists.
Currently, there is a state of emergency and there are rules that, you know, guide that. So the government is saying journalists should not report anything, any issue, you know, that is counterproductive to the current Ebola happenings. You should not report any message that does not have any bearing with the Ebola or that undermines, you know, the work of the Ebola fight in the country. I think that's what the government is seriously standing against. That you report anything that undermines the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, you publish facts, you say facts that, you know, are not in line with, you know, government facts, definitely they are going to arrest you or they will see you as a threat, you know, to the fight against Ebola in the country.
So you mean if a newspaper or a radio station has to report about Ebola, do they have to clear their reports with the government first?
Yes, they need to clear it from the government. And again, they must ensure that their facts goes along with what the Ministry of Health is publishing. For now, they are saying we should forget about politics, you know, and concentrate, you know, on the fight against Ebola. So as a political journalist, you should be very careful on what to report for now until, you know, the state of emergency is called to an end, just as our border Liberians have done.
What's the general feeling of the journalists in the country? Do they feel maybe constrained to report about maybe weaknesses of the handling of the Ebola crisis by the government?
Oh, well, basically, journalists, they are reported. You know, prior to the arrest of the Sambayo, the journalists, you know, we are reporting the issues very well. We are not constrained, you know, with regards to reporting it. Government, you know, was providing trainings for journalists as well as the Sierra Leone of journalists. But since, you know, the arrest of David Sambayo, many journalists have become afraid and skeptical of what they report. So, at least now, many journalists in the country, you know, are afraid of, they are afraid of what to report. I think that's the biggest constraint. The biggest constraint in the country now among journalists is self-censorship. You know, journalists are very careful of what they report. But to say they are getting a direct threat or constraint, no, there is no direct constraint with regards to reporting, you know, this Ebola issue, because, you know, CEO was currently appointed by the president, is open to the press. He ensures that he always calls press conferences and the Ministry of Information and Communication as well also for press conference. So at least the journalists have addressed the issue. There is no major constraint apart from the arrest of the Sambayo.
That was Mohamed Kano, a Sierra Leonean journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from the capital, Freetown. Zimbabwe's Vice President Joyce Mujuru's grip on office and her quest to take over from President Robert Mugabe has been severely weakened. This after ZANU-PF's supreme decision-making body, the Politburo, expelled some of her closest allies. The purge follows First Lady Grace Mugabe's calls on the vice president to resign for harboring presidential ambitions, among other issues. For VOA, Thomas Chiripasi has details.
ZANU-PF Central Committee member Inek Porusungazi, who is among those suspended yesterday, said he is not aware of the charges that led to his suspension. He said he was never asked to appear before a disciplinary committee before yesterday's Politburo decision.
I am shocked, surprised, and heartbroken simply because I do not have the charges against me. I don't know what offense I committed. I'm still waiting to be informed of the offenses. But what I want to say is, if that is the Politburo decision, I will respect it. I respect my Politburo. I cannot argue with it. If the charges are factual, there is evidence.
War Veterans leader Jabulani Sibanda, who was expelled from the ruling party, says he does not know the crime that he committed.
I haven't received anything, my brother, so I cannot comment fully because I don't know the content, I don't know the charge, I don't know anything, so I cannot comment now.
A speculation is rife that those being purged are loyalists of Vice President Joyce Mujuru, who, together with Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa, is angling to succeed President Robert Mugabe when he eventually leaves office. Porusingazi said he belongs to none of the two factions.
That one I can't comment. I belong to President Mugabe. I belong to, in terms of the office that I respect, is the president himself, his entire cabinet, his entire executive in the Politburo, and all structures of the party, which means also my Mujuru is in that group of party stalwarts. We respect their office. It's not that I am practicing factionalism, no.
Analysts say the purge severely weakens Mrs. Mujuru's alleged camp and her ambitions to hold on to her job and eventually replace Mr. Mugabe if he leaves office. Political analyst and programs officer of the Zimbabwe Association of Community Radio Stations, Kudzai Kwangwari, told Studio 7 that as a result of the continuing purging of her key allies, Vice President Mujuru should now raise the white flag. Kwangwari said it was now clear that the ZANU-PF Congress would breed a predetermined outcome.
If I was her, this is the time to raise it. Because, I mean, there have been a lot of allegations against her from not small people, but even big people within the party, including the first lady, serious allegations against her. And if she's that person who has got the conscience of saying, okay, I did not do this, or I'm tarnishing my image, or this, I think this is the time that I say, okay, let me make things clear. I did not do this, but I'm no longer comfortable continuing in this party because of these reasons.
But ZANU-PF member Goodson Nguni says the suspensions and Jabulani Sibanda's expulsion have nothing to do with factionalism in the ruling party. Nguni added that the internal fissures in ZANU-PF are not linked to the race to succeed President Robert Mugabe, who has not groomed a successor in his 34 years in power since independence from Britain in 1980.
Well, first of all, I don't know if it's true that those members who have been removed belong to a faction led by Mai Mujuru, because in 2004, six provincial chairmen were removed, and there was an allegation that they were belonging to Mnangagwa. So I don't know if it is true if those people belong to Mai Mujuru or not. I don't know about that.
Kwangwari said the demonstrations and votes of no confidence against suspected Mujuru allies, including Sibanda's expulsion, were choreographed to give the faction led by Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa an edge over the Mujuru camp ahead of the party's sixth elective congress set for next month. The road to the ruling party's congress thus far, according to Kwangwari, has been marred by undemocratic practices. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
In South Sudan, Jonglei State's Legislative Assembly passed its long-awaited budget 2014 and 2015. The more than 300 million South Sudanese pound budget includes half of the overdue workers' allowances for government employees, some of whom went on strike to protest repeated delays. Although Jonglei officials say they are the first of South Sudan state to provide this payment, some observers say the new budget isn't nearly large enough to solve the state's problems. VOA fellow Lucy Pony has more.
The newly approved Jonglei state budget takes effect immediately. State Finance Minister Dano Obongo says he and his colleagues were waiting for the national government budget to be approved before completing the state budget process. He says lawmakers are extremely proud of this budget, even though lingering security problems remain in Jonglei. Obongo is gratified that officials were able to finally come through on the housing allowance promise for state workers.
I believe among the few states in South Sudan to implement this house allowance.
So our total budget is 327 million, 314,568. This is include our resource envelope and our ceiling, and all this 50% within the our ceiling and our resource envelope.
Obongo says that Jonglei State is the third South Sudan state to pass its budget. He says state government officials must ensure that workers receive their 4 months back pay very soon so that employee morale does not become an issue again. Obongo says they have been given a budget ceiling by the national government, but says they can work within the budget framework.
It will be effective from this month of November immediately. But for your good information, the budget is supposed to start from July. And then we are going to implement. There will be reliability on the government of Jonglei to make sure that these 4 months also are paid for our beloved employees very soon.
Government spokesperson Judy Jonglei says the new state budget allocations reflect many positive initiatives, such as more funding for education, health, water and sanitation services.
We are very proud of as a government that we introduce in this budget 50%. Everybody, I think, should appreciate this. And everybody should really stand with this government. Because this government is actually working for the delivery of the services to the people of Jonglei State. The money we transfer to the counties this year is too much. It's a very big amount to the counties, which is constitute 67 million to the counties. Increase by 30%, 33%.
But even with the progress, Judy says that Jonglei faces increased challenges in the area of non-oil revenue collection. He says if peace is finally achieved between the government and opposition forces, officials may need to increase the allowances of state workers to provide improved services. Judy says the shortfall in oil revenue is part of the reason that Jonglei's budget is smaller than other states. Jonglei State MP Kuol Bol Ayom says it was especially important to recognize the efforts of teachers to ensure that children have continued access to education. He urged school teachers to reopen all schools that were closed due to frustration over the delayed allowance payments they had not received from the government. In October, Jonglei teachers went on strike to demand 10 months of unpaid housing allowances. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
Oil company Shell is under fire once again in Nigeria after Amnesty International publicized court documents saying the company underreported the size of two 2008 oil spills in the Niger Delta. For VOA, Christine has more from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Since 2011, Shell has been fighting a lawsuit by 15,000 people affected by a pair of oil spills that occurred near the village of Bado in the oil-producing Niger Delta region. New court documents published by Amnesty International this week show that the oil company understated the size of the 2008 spills. Amnesty says they also show the company knew some of its pipelines in the Niger Delta were old and prone to failure. Audrey Gokran is the director of global issues at Amnesty International.
Shell has admitted that it underestimated the volume of oil spilled in both spills and the impact of both spills, which is a very significant issue because they've denied that for years. People have given them evidence that they were underestimating, they've denied it repeatedly. The second thing that emerged in these court documents is that Shell has known for years that the pipes going through the Ogoniland area were past a reasonable use-by date, were old, leaky, and in the words in the documents, a hazard. And this has come from internal Shell documents that show that they knew how bad these pipes were.
Shell did not respond to a request for an interview with Voice of America. However, in a statement, the company said it initially estimated that the spills released 4,144 barrels of oil, but later found out that the amount of oil spilled was higher. While Shell did not give an estimate of how much oil was released, Amnesty said their investigation found over 100,000 barrels were spilled in the first accident alone. Gokran said the discrepancy undermines Shell claims that it thoroughly investigates any spills.
They have relied on these oil spill investigations that they've been doing for years, and they've told the world, this is what happens in the Niger Delta, trust us, these are our oil spill investigations. But it's been very odd for investigations that they've now had to admit contain erroneous data and data that underestimated both the volume of oil spills and the impact. And the Bottle community are only one of many communities affected by this.
Shell also denied that its pipelines were faulty, claiming that sabotage was the main cause of most of the spills in its operations in Nigeria. Cochran rejected that idea, saying that the company has overplayed the threat of sabotage.
The claims that Shell is making about sabotage and theft are based on the very same oil spill investigations that Shell has now had to admit, at least in these two Bottle cases, aren't even correct. So Shell's claims about theft and sabotage, issues that do occur in the Delta, but it tends to blame far more oil spills on those than we believe is really the case. It overplays it for PR purposes.
More filings are expected on the case, which is being heard in High Court in London. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Language in Uganda is undergoing a revamp to edit out inconsistencies and add rules to a number of local languages. How do language experts plan to deploy these new changes? One way is through Uganda's first ever local language spelling bee. For VOA, Lisbeth Pollitt has more from the capital, Kampala.
This past week, Uganda hosted spelling bees in local languages around the country. It quizzed children in eight major languages found throughout Uganda, including Acholi, Rutoro, Lusoga, and Runyoro. In Kampala, the Luganda Championship was held. It's part of a local language initiative being taken up by the Ministry of Education. It aims to teach children around Uganda their local language first, before they are taught in English. It also aims to cement and regulate these languages with clear and concise grammar rules.
Omchuzi.
Omchuzi.
Children from Gomba, Masaka, and Kampala districts met in the capital, where they competed for a championship title. In the end, it went to 10-year-old Judith Nemutembe from Kamulegu Primary in Masaka. Lauren Evans, who manages education programs for UNICEF, helped come up with the idea for a local language spelling bee. He explains how experts are helping the language evolve while improving education.
It's never been formalized. It's always just been some linguist in the past went, and oh, that's what this sounds like, and wrote it down in the characters of their native language, and that's all it's ever been. And so they finally got groups of people together that are kind of authorities on the language that can go, okay, of the 15 ways we see this word spelled, this is the one that's going to be right. And in some groups, like Lablongo, they're so intense into it, and the way they've done it, it makes so much sense that in good schools, some of the ones I visited, the pupils there are reading and writing at a level higher than students in the United States.
The programs were created in part with UNICEF, the Peace Corps, and language boards throughout Uganda. Annette Mpuga, who works for the Reading Association of Uganda, explains how her local language will benefit from the Luganda Local Language Board revising the rules.
Luganda is most spoken in the central region in Uganda, and that language. Mm-hmm. It is easily spoken, but very difficult to write. Because the formation of the words in that language is not the formation in English. They used people to ask them, how do you pronounce this word? So they taught them how to write, and then these people changed it, changed the vowel and everything, because otherwise we wouldn't have the R, A, E, O that is in our language.
Creators of these programs are hoping that spelling bees will give people a vested interest in their own cultural languages and promote a competitive edge in children. They are counting on this combination to fuel interest in literacy across Uganda, so these new orthographies will catch on with future generations. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
What exactly is Ebola?
Can I catch Ebola through the air?
Are the people who have it contagious?
What is our government doing about Ebola?
What are the symptoms of Ebola? You have questions about Ebola? Straight Talk Africa has answers. VOA presents Straight Talk Africa, Ebola. Knowledge is life. A special town hall meeting with leading experts on the front lines who will answer many of the questions surrounding the Ebola outbreak. VOA presents Straight Talk Africa, Ebola, Knowledge is Life. November 19th, only on VOA.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 16th. With the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations hosting issues now resolved, 10 teams have qualified for the finals of the tournament. Shortly before the kickoff of the penultimate round of qualifying matches this weekend, African soccer's governing body, CAF, announced Equatorial Guinea as the host of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations finals. Earlier disqualified from the playoffs for fielding an ineligible player, Equatorial Guinea replaces Morocco, which refused to host the 2015 tournament over Ebola fears. By virtue of being host, Equatorial Guinea qualifies automatically for the finals. It will be joined by South Africa, Algeria, Gabon, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Zambia, Tunisia, and Senegal. All the teams pick the tickets before the final round of qualifying matches due to be played on Wednesday. Let's quickly run through how the teams qualified. South Africa becomes the first and only team to have qualified from Group A after beating hard-fighting Sudan 2-1 on Saturday to amass an unassailable 11 points. Algeria is also the only team to have so far qualified from Group B after beating Ethiopia 3-1 on Saturday. The Algerians pick the ticket with 15 points, with one match to play. The top two teams from Group C have already emerged. They are Gabon and Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso beat Lesotho 1-0, while Angola and Gabon played goalless. Cameroon is the only team to have emerged from Group D. The Indomitable Lions beat their counterparts from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, 1-0 on Saturday to raise their total points to 13. There are no qualifiers yet from Group E. Cape Verde and Zambia picked the two tickets from Group F. This weekend, Zambia beat Mozambique 1-0, while Cape Verde trounced Niger 3-1. Also, two teams, Tunisia and Senegal, emerged from Group G. Tunisia played goalless with Botswana on Friday, while Senegal pipped Egypt 1-0. Now, the full results of weekend matches at a glance. Group A, South Africa 2, Sudan 1, Congo 0, Nigeria 2. Group B, Malawi 2, Mali 0, Algeria 3, Ethiopia 1. Group C, Lesotho 0, Burkina Faso 1, Angola 0, Gabon 0. Group D, Sierra Leone 1, Ivory Coast 5, Cameroon 1, DR Congo 0. Group E, Uganda 1, Ghana 0, Togo 1, Guinea 4. Group F, Mozambique 0, Zambia 1, Cape Verde 3, Niger 1. And Group G, Botswana 0, Tunisia 0, Egypt 0, Senegal 1. As I reported earlier, the final set of group qualifying matches will be played across the continent on Wednesday, after which the remaining six finalists will emerge. Here are the fixtures. Group A, Nigeria hosts South Africa. Congo travels to Sudan. Group B, Mali plays host to Algeria. Ethiopia is at home to Malawi. Group C, Burkina Faso hosts Angola. Gabon hosts Lesotho. Group D, Ivory Coast takes on visiting Cameroon, while DR Congo hosts Sierra Leone. Group E, it's Ghana at home to Togo and Guinea at home to Uganda. Group F, Cape Verde travels to Zambia, while Mozambique goes to Niger. And Group G, Tunisia hosts Egypt in a clash of North Africans, while Senegal hosts Botswana. Let's remind our listeners that the finals of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations will be played from January 17th to February 8th in four cities in Equatorial Guinea. Back here in Nigeria, President Goodluck Jonathan has congratulated the country's national football team, the Super Eagles, for their, quote, dogged and hard-fought victory, unquote, over the Red Devils of Congo on Saturday. The victory has revived Nigeria's hopes of qualifying for next year's Africa Cup of Nations finals. A presidency statement said President Jonathan applauds the Super Eagles' patriotic, determined, and very courageous display in front of a very vociferous, aggressive, and partisan home crowd, which earned them an emphatic 2-0 victory and place Nigeria in good position once again for qualification to defend its African title. The president assured the Super Eagles and their handlers of his government's full support for the final qualification match against South Africa on Wednesday. Nigeria's chances of getting an automatic ticket to the 2015 finals have brightened with the victory over Congo. The victory means that the Super Eagles will get a ticket by beating South Africa on Wednesday because they have now scored more goals than Congo in their two meetings. Ever reliable goalkeeper Vincent Nyama, who stopped a Congo penalty, as well as Ikeuchi and Aaron Samuel, who scored Nigeria's two goals, are the heroes of the match. Meanwhile, a Nigerian sports analyst has called on CAF to severely punish Morocco for its failure to host the 2015 African Nations Cup Finals. Segun Aribike is a former editor-in-chief of the news agency of Nigeria. He says Ebola fears are not enough to justify Morocco's refusal to host the tournament.
At any rate, don't forget that the countries that where you have the Ebola crisis, the three countries, Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone, have been playing their matches outside of their nations. So what is the problem? At any rate, and I also know that as we speak, the Guineans play their matches in Morocco. They never complain about that. If I may add too, I think CAF should seriously do something about this situation. They need to be punished. It's a shame. It's a shame. If the Equatorial Guineans were not readily available, then what are we talking about? What would we be doing? We will not host. We will not have the championship. You know what you will have done to a generation of African footballers who probably will be playing for the first time or probably the last tournament. I think the Moroccans, there must be more to it. I don't know, but I that's why I think CAF should investigate this and punish them more. It's not enough to say they have been thrown out of next year's tournament.
That was Segun Aribike, a former editor-in-chief of the news agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me right here in Lagos. Finally, Brazilian soccer legend Pelé was discharged from his Sao Paulo hospital on Saturday after doctors removed kidney stones that had been obstructing his urinary tract. The 74-year-old was admitted to the Albert Einstein Hospital on Wednesday with abdominal pains that forced him to cancel a book signing event in Santos, where he lives. Known as the King of Soccer in Brazil, Pelé is widely regarded as the finest player to grace the sport. He was named Football Player of the Century by World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, Athlete of the Century by the International Olympic Committee, and a National Treasure by Brazil's government. Pelé played in four World Cups and helped Brazil win the global tournament three times, the last in Mexico in 1970. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
She keep you the really share. I see how you're moving there. You better just stay in line. All I wanna do is just make you mine. You make my heart beat like playing rhyme. Now you won't leave and say goodbye. After calling it, you know say you drive me crazy. I'm calling you do me shady. The things that you do don't pay me. Love me baby, you know say you drive me crazy. I'm calling you do me shady. The things that you do don't pay me.
Oh, my baby. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I go carry you, girl. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I go carry you. Cause now you ready for my mind. I just wanna make you mine. I'm ready to go the extra mile for you, baby. You, carry go. Beauty, yes, I go. My yellow CC, I don't go Soweto, America, Toronto. If I say make a call, the results. The number one, you be on my Niger photogenic.
Hey, you are photogenic.
African baby photogenic.
Hey, you are photogenic.
The way you smile, they do me something. I no deny the way you make it. Oh, my baby, make I snap you photo.
My sugar, my baby, my lover. Okay. We can ride around in the Rover. Okay. From Owerri all the way to Dover. Okay. My sweetie, my sugar, my baby, my lover. Uh-huh. We can ride around in the Rover. Okay. From Owerri all the way to Dover. Okay. Hey, don't leave my, wait a minute, but you could go ahead, just give me the digits. Hey. I'm a broken record, but you can fix it. Uh-huh. Wiz did it, so I had to remix it. So photogenic, you don't need no makeup. Look the same in pics, the way she wakes up. I'm sorry, boo-boo, but I had to tell you how it is. Watch me so you can tell what time it is.
I'm on night job, what
hey, you are photogenic.
African baby, photogenic.
I'm really shaking. Oh, my ladies.
Oh, my baby. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo.
Oh, my ladies.
Oh, my ladies.
Oh, my ladies.
Make I snap you photo.
And I'm here to you. Okay. I get the money, yo. Okay.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. How amazing that once the results of the recent midterm elections were known in the United States, the national media reporting on Ebola outbreak mercifully abated. Prior to the midterm elections, it was difficult to escape the constant emotive broadcasts, comments, and editorials about the dangerous Ebola outbreak. In the circumstances of this constant total press reporting about Ebola, the American people became frightened and agitated. Some politicians even exploited the Ebola crisis for electoral purposes. Politicians unbelievably blamed President Obama for bringing Ebola to United States shores. And the even accused him of negligence and incompetence in handling Ebola. They could not explain, however, what he could have done to deal with the Liberian national who came to the United States after he had been infected in Liberia. But this is the way the press handled the situation during the election. There were also other unhelpful comments about Ebola before the elections. Some politicians proposed that nationals of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone should be banned from entering the United States. They even suggested that those who had gone to help in West Africa should be quarantined on their return. Now, however, after the midterm results, some amount of tranquility has returned. People now talk about Ebola in a rational manner. President Obama has followed up by asking Congress to approve a $6 billion Ebola funding to assist in the global fight against Ebola in West Africa. He wanted them to proceed during the so-called lame duck session. There have been some hopeful signs in Monrovia, where it is suggested that the Ebola outbreak is slowing down. In this regard, President Johnson Sirleaf lifted the emergencies in Monrovia, although there are reports that in Lofa County, Ebola is increasing. Unfortunately, in Sierra Leone and in Guinea, there are many problems, but efforts are being made to tackle those problems in both countries. The Ebola scare has also affected football in Africa. The Africa competition got into some difficulties when Morocco decided not to hold the competition and requested postponement. The association in Africa refused, and Morocco was expelled from the competition. Fortunately, Equatorial Guinea has stepped in, and they will host the competition. The ambassador of Equatorial Guinea in London was asked why our country was taking the competition, giving the scare over Ebola. She appropriately said that our country was aware of the scare, but they want to act according to hope rather than live on scare. In Sierra Leone, Dr. Sila, a national of Sierra Leone but with a permanent residence in the United States, was diagnosed with the Ebola disease. He is being flown to Nebraska, where the results have been very good, 100% success, and hopefully he will be able to leave the hospital free of Ebola. Our prayers go to him and his frightened family in the United States. Politics and the constant stigmatization aside, there are some evidence that the international community is beginning to get its handle on the Ebola crisis. However, the travel ban, which WHO has said was not necessary, continues. And one country in Africa, Kenya Airways, has suffered tremendous loss because of its policy on banning travelers from West Africa. Hopefully, we can proceed in the coming days to see more international efforts to find the vaccine, which are now being tested in some African countries, and by next year, perhaps we will be able to see great progress and the end of the Ebola crisis. I thank you.
Thanks very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former Under Secretary General for Political Affairs at the UN. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the Malawian elders say, when a monkey climbs a tree, its bottom becomes more exposed the higher it goes. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. President Barack Obama recently announced in Beijing that the United States and the People's Republic of China have concluded a reciprocal visa validity arrangement for tourists, business travelers, and students that will strengthen the broadening economic and people-to-people ties between the United States and China. The United States and China began issuing visas in accordance with the new reciprocal arrangement on November 12, 2014. Chinese applicants who qualify for a B-category non-immigrant visa may now be issued multiple entry visas for a period of up to 10 years for business and tourism travel. Chinese students and exchange visitors and their dependents who qualify for F, M, or J-category visas are now eligible for multiple entry visas valid for up to 5 years or the length of their program. U.S. citizens eligible for Chinese short-term business and tourist visas will also receive multiple entry visas valid for up to 10 years, while qualified U.S. students may receive student residency permits valid up to 5 years, depending on the length of their educational program. By facilitating easier business and leisure travel, this reciprocal arrangement will improve trade, investment, and business ties between the United States and China. The new 10-year validity is the longest visa validity possible under U.S. law. Previously, Chinese and American business travelers and tourists had to apply for a new visa each year. Extended validity visas for students and exchange visitors will boost people-to-people connections by easing travel restrictions for students who attend U.S. institutions of higher education. Before this new arrangement, many Chinese students who left the United States for short visits were required to apply for new visas to re-enter the country. This new visa arrangement underscores the U.S. commitment to promote bilateral tourism and trade and increase opportunities for people-to-people engagement with China.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.